WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV. This broadcast is dedicated to bringing you the truth behind the news.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. Last night, Americans heard from Republican candidates who want to be president. Out in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Fox News hosted a debate that brought together eight of those candidates, minus the frontrunner. Donald Trump decided it was pointless to subject himself to harassment from a cast of characters, all of whom are at least 40 points behind him in every poll. Instead, while Fox aired the debates, former top TV host for Fox and current GOP maker Tucker Carlson posted his interview with Trump. The interview had garnered more than 150 million views by the morning of the next day. And what's an interview with Trump that doesn't include talk about rigged elections? Here is a short montage of what Trump said about the 2020 election, election integrity in general, and the 2024 election.
But the election was rigged. It was a rigged election. And with COVID, they used COVID to cheat in a lot of different things, and we have so much on it. It's like so easy. But we had judges that didn't want to look. We had people didn't want to get involved. He's a conspiracy theorist if you say anything about the election. Even no voter ID. I mean, why don't they want voter ID? There's only one reason they don't want voter ID, because they want to cheat. I mean, who doesn't want, you know, the Democrat convention, the last one, they had voter ID that was this big. It looked like a prison card, this big on their chest. You walked in, they had your picture, your this, your fingerprint. They had everything. The most incredible voter ID I've ever seen. That was to get into the Democrat National Convention. But to get in to vote, if you buy groceries, if you buy practically anything now, you have ID on a card, credit cards or otherwise.
Don't you think it's racist to have to show your ID?
Well, they probably say that. They use anything not to show ID, because voter ID is pretty simple. And we could go back, and we should go back to all paper ballots, voter ID, same-day voting. You know, France did it. France had mail-in ballots, and it was terrible. Anytime you have mail-in ballots, you're going to have massive cheating on your elections. Anytime, but not just the presidential election. Anytime you have...
Isn't that the whole point of them?
Yeah. So you can cheat? Yeah, sure. It's their whole point. That's their whole point. They want to cheat. Yeah. They have to cheat because their policies are so bad that if they didn't cheat, they couldn't get elected. Who wants open borders? Who wants high taxes? Who wants high interest rates? Who wants to not be able to use a gas stove? And by the way, you're talking about cheating on the election. McLaughlin and Fabrizio, great pollsters, they said a thing like that plus other things meant anywhere from 10 to 17% of the vote would change.
You're saying they stole it from you last time. Why wouldn't they do the same this time?
Oh, well, they'll try. They're going to be trying, yeah. And not only me, you know.
The conversation also touched on the man who's in the White House now. Here's what Trump had to say about Joe Biden.
Because crooked Joe Biden is so bad. He's the worst president in the history of our country. I don't think he's going to make it to the gate, but, you know, you never know. But he's a corrupt person, so corrupt that I took the name off Hillary. You know, I don't do two people at one time. I took the crooked Hillary and I retired the name. That was a good day for her. I bet she was very happy. And I used it for Joe because it's crooked Joe. But Joe is really...
But you don't think he's going to make it to November of 24?
Well, I think he's worse mentally than he is physically. And physically, he's not exactly a triathlete or any kind of an athlete. You look at him, he can't walk to the helicopter. He walks. He can't lift his feet out of the grass. You know, it's only 2 inches at the White House, right? That's not a lot. See, I think he's the most corrupt president we've ever had. And he also has the distinction of being the most incompetent. And I believe both. I mean, he's both incompetent and corrupt.
So
and
I
actually believe he's compromised because China knows so much about him. They know where the money comes from. They know where it is, who paid it, and they probably paid it. Well, they do pay Penn, and he gets $1 million. I think he takes $999,000 because, you know, keeps it a little bit under a million, like by a dollar. But he, in many ways, is a Manchurian candidate. We have a Manchurian candidate.
Tucker asked Trump what his top priority be if he were to win again. And here's what Trump had to say.
Let's say number one is a border and taking hundreds of thousands of criminals that have been allowed into our country and getting them out and bringing them back to their country, Guatemala.
The last question that Tucker asked was about the potential for a civil war. Let's hear what Trump had to say about that.
Do you think we're moving towards civil war?
There's tremendous passion and there's tremendous love. And I've also never seen simultaneously and from the same people such hatred of what they've done to our country.
So do you think it's possible that there's open conflict? We seem to be moving towards something.
I don't know, because I don't know what it, you know, I can say this. There's a level of passion that I've never seen. There's a level of hatred that I've never seen. And that's probably a bad combination.
Join me to discuss today's stories is editor-in-chief of the New American Magazine, Gary Benoit. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Paul.
So it's been a busy last 12 hours for us and everyone there, and we'll be talking about what was happening on the other side over there in Milwaukee. But this last question about the Civil War, the potential for this unrest, this is a question and this is a thought that is almost certainly on the minds of, I'd say, our viewers and whatnot. Things are getting really crazy. There's a lot of corruption. And with every passing day, we learn about more about the corruption. Gary, why would the deep state benefit from a civil war? I know that we advocate for holding the union together, and that's always been our position. Why is that, and why would a civil war benefit the deep state?
Well, first of all, if we had a civil war today, I don't think it would be along state lines as such. It might be more along the lines of urban versus rural. It would be people who love the Constitution, people who love freedom, and people who support the globalist agenda, people who support the statist agenda. But the reason it would benefit, I believe, the insiders, the power elites, is because the violence and the crime could be used as rationales to consolidate power in Washington, D.C., and indeed, not just in Washington, D.C., but also on an international level.
Well, it would also make the United States weaker, obviously, right?
Right.
And that's what they're, I mean, all these multi-front attacks, assaults mm-hmm. On the United States, including from the United Nations, mm-hmm. Their point is to destroy the United States, right? So a civil war would bring us there, would it not?
Well, they would want to destroy the United States in terms of the United States being a free and independent nation. I mean, who knows? They might preserve the American flag. They might preserve some trappings that mm-hmm. We would view today as representing America. Mm. But what they want is to submerge the United States of America into this new world order that they are building.
Yeah. Now, during that conversation, there was talk about getting China out of Cuba. Mm-hmm. Trump said he would do that. There was even talk about Epstein. Trump said he believed that Epstein probably did really kill himself. It seemed like he was almost projecting a little bit, because he said the reason he would believe that is because here is someone who led such a lavish and luxurious lifestyle, and to face the prospect of being in prison for the rest of your life is something he couldn't handle, which seemed like pretty
right.
Rash,
it's certainly a possibility. I believe the evidence points otherwise, though.
Yeah.
The evidence points in the direction of his having been suicided. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, I don't know that anyone can say for sure.
Right. Absolutely. And then this talk about election, security elections, you mentioned paper ballots, voter IDs, mm-hmm. Banning, getting rid of mail-in right. ballots, and how it's used for cheating.
Yeah. And that was really wonderful to hear that. But right. I think there's an opportunity there, Paul, for us to boast a little bit, because, you know, as we know, and our regular viewers know, the New American Magazine is part of the John Birch Society. And if you go back to the very beginning, the John Birch Society, and when the New American was started, which was an outgrowth of previous publications that we have advocated again and again and again the use of paper ballots. And, of course, Trump is absolutely correct that when you move away from paper ballots and you move in the direction of mail-in voting,
yeah.
that is going to be ripe with fraud. It just provides an opportunity. And I love, too, what he said about ID. I mean, if an 18-year-old, let's say, goes into a liquor store and he's not supposed to be able to buy the alcohol until he turns 21, he has to demonstrate that he's 21. And he can't do that if he doesn't have an ID showing that he's 21. So why is it okay to use an ID in that instance, but it's not okay to use an ID to show that you are on the voter rolls, that you are the person you are claiming right. to be? And it doesn't make any sense whatsoever, does it, Paul?
Well,
unless, of course,
sense.
The conclusion, which Trump drew accurately, the conclusion is they want to cheat.
Yes, that's absolutely. I remember attending a meeting of GOP here in Appleton, and lots of concerned citizens showed up, and they said, you know, they talked about securing elections, cleaning voter rolls, and all this. And the representatives from the state legislature, GOP representatives, said, look, every time we try to do something that secures our election, the Democrats fight tooth and nail. They sue, they take them to court,
right.
they do whatever they can. And it's clear they want to cheat. Let's go to the other side of the primary.
Okay.
All right, folks, we're going to go into news about what the other side of this Republican primary yielded. Entering the debate hosted by Fox News, Governor Ron DeSantis was the front runner of everyone other than, in the words of moderator Brett Baer, the elephant not in the room, Donald Trump. In fact, one American news network went so far as to air the Trump interview as it was playing on X, or formerly known as Twitter. Here's OAN's pre-debate announcement.
Forget the debate, watch Tucker and Trump, and we'll see you tomorrow night.
Forget the debate? Well, OAN called it right. As the Gateway pundit reported this morning, boom, Trump breaks the internet. More people watched the Trump-Tucker interview than total voters in the 2020 U.S. election. Over 170 million views and counting. Earlier we had said that it was about 150 by the morning, so it had obviously climbed. But what happened at the debate is still more important. So let's listen to some highlights. And perhaps a good place to start with is, you guessed it, Donald Trump.
If former President Trump is convicted in a court of law, would you still support him as your party's choice? Please raise your hand if you would.
Most of the presidential elections on the stage raised their hands, but not former Governor Chris Christie.
Whether or not you believe that the criminal charges are right or wrong, the conduct is beneath the office of President of the United States.
Former Vice President Mike Pence, once again demonstrating just how tone-deaf he is to the anti-establishment sentiments of the American people, attacked fellow candidate Vivek Ramaswamy for being a rookie.
Joe Biden has weakened this country at home and abroad. Now is not the time for on-the-job training. We don't need to bring in a rookie. We don't need to bring in people without experience.
I wonder if Pence remembers that Joe Biden was the opposite of a rookie when he became president. Does Pence really think that criticizing a candidate for not being an establishment politician would win him brownie points in today's political climate? So far, as Ramaswamy is concerned, here's a bright spot that should resonate with informed Americans who know how the climate change is a hoax used to beguile people into accepting totalitarian controls.
Let us be honest as Republicans. I'm the only person on the stage who isn't bought and paid for, so I can say this. The climate change agenda is a hoax.
Two thumbs up for Ramaswamy on that one. Yet, unfortunately, none of the candidates on the Republican debate stage last night is a constitutionalist, which is what we need in all of our elected positions. And for that matter, neither is Donald Trump. Of course, there's no question that there were candidates on last night's debate stage who would do a far better job in the White House than Joe Biden. But that particular hurdle is not a high hurdle to overcome. That's so unfortunate, Gary, that we are there. But I like to think that we are getting better. Next week, I'm doing an interview with an up-and-comer out of Montana. He's got a perfect Freedom Index score, and look forward to that, folks.
Who is that? Who is that upcomer?
Representative Matt Rosendale.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And not exactly a household word.
No, he's not. He's not.
But he's really distinguishing himself by the fact that ever since he's been elected to Congress, consistently he has scored 100% on our Freedom Index that looks at the voting records of congressmen compared to the oath of office that they take to the U.S. Constitution.
Right.
He's been 100% every single time.
Yeah. And we have some other really good ones, too. We interviewed Senator Ron Johnson here in Wisconsin, and he keeps getting better. He realizes what's happening. And there's a handful full of others. Yeah. But, man.
He shows that term limits in terms of saying you only can have so many terms, that form of term limits, is really not the way to go, because Ron Johnson, his voting record is actually better today than it was when he first was elected to the U.S. Senate.
Right. Well, an idea of term limits is kind of redundant, or
because we have it in the form of the ballot box.
Right, right. It's like, okay, you don't want to vote them out.
Term limits, the way it's used today, is a nice way of saying we want to take away the franchise from the American voter.
Right. But so we got Vivek and DeSantis, and they're the closest ones to Trump. But it doesn't look right now that they're getting anywhere near him. Now, obviously, if he gets thrown in jail or something like that, which Steve Bonta, who often co-hosts here, he thinks that's going to happen, then we may end up with one of these two. And you know, they both...
And I don't know. Maybe... But could Trump still run for president in a jail cell? I really do not know.
Yeah. But what is your take as far as, again, I mentioned this, and I don't mean to make you sound old, but you have been reporting for a long time. You've been at the helm here of the New American, and you've seen so many presidential candidates. What is your take as far as their aligning with the Constitution? Is it getting better or is it getting worse?
Well, at the very least, it's getting better in terms of the rhetoric. And the reason the rhetoric is getting better, I believe, is because the people are becoming more informed. And I think the people are becoming more informed because of the work of the John Birch Society and other patriots, other people who love freedom, who have been informing their fellow citizens. And that's what brought about what we call MAGA to begin with. Before MAGA, there was the Tea Party. And, of course, there were other things before that. There was moral majority, for example. But the people are waking up, and that is changing the political rhetoric. And that is a really wonderful thing.
I would argue, I mean, I don't think it's just in rhetoric. I mean, you look at DeSantis and Trump. We did an episode, was it a week or two ago, why they hate Trump. And we showed several instances where he pushed back on globalist entanglements
and things I agree.
Like that. But then, of course, DeSantis, what he did in Florida, that was more than rhetoric.
Yep. I agree completely. But I believe it starts with the rhetoric, because politicians do know what they need to say in order to get into office. But obviously, we have politicians who really mean it. And I know regarding Trump in particular, when he ran for president for the first time in 2016, I was really questioning whether or not he was just saying what he was saying because he wanted to get elected. And he did do some things that clashed with constitutional principles, but nonetheless, he did a lot of things that were in support of constitutional principles, and he ended up being a much better president than I imagine prior to his election.
I heard
that. But he would not have gotten elected in the first place, Paul, if it were not for the change in terms of the thinking of the American people, in terms of people
Trump
becoming
world,
informed
right?
and involved.
If it weren't for Trump world, right? This was the thesis of our bookazine some time ago. The idea that Trump created MAGA or Trump world is obviously flawed, because he would have no way to get in office without MAGA, without Trump world. And so we do recommend everyone get this. We're not just hawking stuff, but we recommend you get this. You can go to JBS.org.
Absolutely.
And,
we can't overstate the point that it's not sufficient simply to vote. It's necessary to cast an informed ballot.
Absolutely.
Let's not forget that Hitler came into power in Nazi Germany, for example, because the German people were uninformed.
That's such a good point. Thank you, Gary. Well, hey, folks, it's almost time for the John Birch Society's Leadership Conference. This year, we're holding our annual event in Des Moines, Iowa. We'll be discussing strategies that you can use to restore our nation and prevent civil war, and we'll bring plenty of materials that you can take back home with you. This will also be a great opportunity for us to meet you and for you to meet other like-minded patriots. Our keynote speaker will be Dr. Ryan Cole, whose discussion topic will be the death of science, medical freedom in an era of lies. Other speakers include James Patrick, the film director of the movie Nitrogen 2000, former Iowa U.S. Congressman Steve King, election expert Dr. Douglas Frank, and the New American's Alex Newman. You can learn more about this conference and get your tickets at jbs.org. Or if you prefer to call, you can do so at 1-800-527-8721. Again, get your tickets at jbs.org or by calling 1-800-527-8721. Stay tuned because we will be right back with more Truth Behind the News.
Freedom is the cure.
You're dead on. This is the largest experiment performed on human beings in the history of the world.
The more you know.
What they're doing is they're forcing vaccination on people, and I believe they are killing people with this vaccination.
The freer you are.
It's murder. They are basically murdering people in hospitals.
The all-cause mortality, we know, is now higher in the vaccinated group than the unvaccinated group.
Stay informed on the issues that affect freedom. Get a subscription to The New American today, thenewamerican.com.
Welcome back. In a significant but not surprising development in Russia, Yevgeny Prigozhin died yesterday in a plane crash near Moscow. Prigozhin was the fiery leader of the Wagner mercenary group who led a short-lived military uprising against Vladimir Putin's government earlier this summer. His private jet, which was carrying 10 people, including him, plummeted from the sky shortly after takeoff in a crash that killed everyone aboard. Among the dead is Prigozhin's second-in-command, Dmitry Utkin, a Nazi and SS enthusiast and the original founder of the Wagner Group. We don't know what caused the crash, but witnesses reported hearing two explosions, and it has been claimed by many sources that the plane was deliberately shot down. Back in June, Prigozhin had become very critical of Putin and his circle of military leaders. After a surprise attack from the rear on a Wagner encampment killed hundreds of fighters, Prigozhin retaliated by launching an uprising in southern Russia. His troops quickly seized control of Rostov-on-Don, the Russian Southern Command Center for the war, and then moved north toward Moscow, shooting down several Russian aircraft on their way up. It seemed like Russia was headed toward an all-out civil war. Putin even called Prigozhin a traitor on national television. But a truce was announced, was it? And the mercenary leader and his forces were allowed to go into exile in Belarus. But now, with theories swirling wildly through Russia, Wagner representatives are warning of taking revenge if Prigozhin has indeed been taken out by the government. He was a brutal warlord, but was very popular in Russia, including with the military, his Wagner forces having been more successful than military regulars in parts of Ukraine. His death may yet have far-reaching consequences. Okay, Gary, so I actually have a story about this. This is a staple. Staged accidents are a staple of Eastern European commie assassinations. I think maybe people are listening now and they would argue it's like, well, CIA, whatever. I'm sure they're pulling that stuff too. But I actually have a relative, and I don't want to reveal too much about him, but back in the old country, he was an activist, and he was an activist for the rights and to stop the persecution of evangelicals, especially
while the country was still communist.
While the country was still communist in Romania, see, the communists had infiltrated the Orthodox Church, mm-hmm. the Catholic Church, largely whatever. But the one they had really a hard time controlling was the evangelicals. And so they had informants. They threw him in jail. I think the most famous example is Richard Wurmbrand, who we know
Torture as for Torture Christ for was Christ. The book he wrote.
That's the kind of stuff they did. So anyway, my relative, he started a group of type, a lobbying group to defend the rights of evangelicals, to stop being treated as second-class citizens, to stop persecuting, to stop grabbing them and throwing them in jail and whatnot. So he turned into a bit of a troublemaker. So they ended up calling him in, you know, to their offices, to bases, whatever, a couple times, telling them stop it. When he said, no, I won't, then they said, leave. You know, they wanted him to leave. They're like, look, dude, you can leave. That was actually, most people wanted to leave and they couldn't, but they were telling him.
In other words, leave the country.
Leave the country.
Right.
And he said, no, I'm a patriot. I'm fighting for the rights of Christians and Romanians all over. And then They tried to kill him in a staged car accident. And he's written about this. I don't know if it's been published in the book or whatnot. But he was walking home from somewhere and someone just hit him. Okay, but he didn't die. And then that person got out of the car. They were coming toward him. But just as that person was coming out, someone came and picked him up and took him to the hospital. At the hospital, they tried to bully the surgeon into letting him die. The surgeon, who apparently had some leverage because of his skills, said no, he didn't. Anyway, short story. Let's keep the story short. Years later, he ended up in the United States. He did end up leaving because he realized he was going to be dead. The person who tried to kill him actually got a hold of him after communism had officially failed and whatnot. And he told him he wanted to talk to him, and he admitted that that was the case. So this is how they operate. They still operate there. And I imagine this is how commies and totalitarians and these people, these mercenaries operate.
Right. Now, are you saying your relative is still alive?
He's alive. He's alive. He's well and fine. I talked to him here and there. He loves America. He's still a Romanian patriot, and he's an American patriot. But all that to say is it's like this is out in Russia, in Eastern Europe. When they hear things like this, the first thing that comes to mind is, like, this was obviously an assassination.
Right. You know, it's interesting you say that, Paul, because it makes me recall KAL Flight 7. And, of course, a lot of our viewers, I'm sure, would not remember that, but this goes back to 1983. Larry McDonald, who was a really important member of the U.S. Congress at the time and also chairman of the John Birch Society. Mm-hmm. But more than that, or I should say in addition to that, was also organizing anti-communist throughout the world. In fact, he was on that flight to go to South Korea for a convention with anti-communists. And that flight, KAL-7, that Larry McDonald was on board as well as many others, was shot down by a Soviet missile. And we don't have the proof to be able to say this, but I think the probability is extremely high that that aircraft, that passenger plane, was targeted because Larry McDonald was on board.
Why would they do that? Was he that much of a threat?
He really was. He was a huge threat because he wasn't just a congressman. He also was an organizer. Again, he was chairman of the John Birch Society. But he also had this group called Western Goals that was working with others and doing research in terms of exposing the conspiracy. And again, he was organizing anti-communists. And also at that time, there was a publication called the Conservative Digest. And they took a survey of their readers as to which person in the United States, which national figure most closely represented their views. And they chose Larry McDonald as that person.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen older interviews of Larry McDonald, and of course, we know quite a bit about him. You could see why he would be a threat to the deep state and any totalitarian. He was articulate. He was quick-witted, and he was a fervent defender of freedom. And so it makes sense. But like you said, this is obviously something that, you know, it's rumors and speculation because we don't have the proof. But even of all publications, even The Nation said that investigation was highly, highly suspect.
It certainly was. And even though we don't have the proof to show that that plane was targeted because Larry McDonald was on board, the evidence is overwhelming. In fact, we know absolutely that that plane was not blown out of the sky, period, which is the official narrative. We know based on radar trackings from Japan, for instance, that was in the air for at least 12 minutes. After 12 minutes, it went below 1,000 feet and also turned direction to head back to Soviet territory, presumably to try to make an emergency landing.
Yeah.
So there's a possibility, in fact, I think likelihood, that there were many survivors, including Larry McDonald.
Thank you, Gary. Thanks for bringing that up again.
Thank you.
Well, that's all for our news segment today, folks. For more Truth Behind the News, make sure you get a subscription to The New American Magazine. You can do that online at thenewamerican.com, or you can call our office, 800-727-8783, Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 Central Time. Stay tuned, because we will be right back with more New American TV.
Imprisonment, forced labor, permanent separation from my family. Perhaps death. I knew what could happen to people who were caught trying to defect. But the watchtowers stood yards away. The possibility of a new life in a different world, one without tyranny, was within sight. The West. I thought of the rewards no longer crushed under the boot of communism. I would work and make money, no longer restrained by the chains of collectivism. I would say what I wanted, without fear of spies and informants nearby. I would be free. The frozen rain and Romanian mud seeped through my gloves and cloths. I fantasized about a fire burning in the wood stove of my parents' home, but I pushed those thoughts from my mind, closed my eyes, and waited for the cover of the darkness.
Get Defector, a true story of tyranny, liberty, and purpose by Mark Hobovkovich with Paul Dragoo, a thrilling page-turner that will remind you how precious yet vulnerable freedom is. Available at shopjbs.org or Amazon. For a limited time, get 20% off your entire order using promo code DEFECTOR20 when you purchase Defector at shopjbs.org.
George Santayana's heavily used quote, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it," is true. But is the general lack of historical understanding in America a result of simple ignorance, or is it a calculated agenda to subvert the spread of America's religious, moral, and constitutional heritage to youth? Next up, in Conversations That Matter, Alex Newman interviews Jane Cook about the teaching of American history. Jane Cook is a former White House communications staffer, author, and presidential historian. She tells Alex that there is an agenda, and she shares how, through the distribution of real documented history, a new love for our nation's heritage can be cultivated. Let's listen.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Conversations That Matter. I'm your host, Alex, and we have a very special guest with us. Her name is Jane Cook, and she is an author of numerous books, including one that I have here, The Submarine and the Spies, Friendship and Vigilance in the American Revolution. She's an expert on the history of our country, which, of course, our young people just don't know anymore. In my opinion, it's a tragedy. She's written 13 books, mostly dealing with American history. She was the former White House webmaster. And she's got three new books out, including this one that I just mentioned. She's got War of Lies, A History Mystery, and First Fireworks for Independence, which is a children's book. She just read it recently at one of these Kirk Cameron Library events alongside John Solomon, who read from his own children's book. Jane, welcome to the program. It is great to have you. You know, I want to talk even before we get into the specifics of your book. We have a crisis in our country, as you know. The latest government data shows that I think something like 13% of American young people are even proficient. These are eighth graders in U.S. history. And of course, even that history that they're allegedly proficient in is not necessarily actually what happened. Talk about this crisis. How did we get here and why is this so dangerous for our country?
Well, I think that we got here because we're not doing a good job of teaching, you know, our history. And we've got, you know, a lot of these other influences, the woke culture is steering people away from original source material on history and misinterpreting history. I think that's one factor. And I also think we don't do a good job of blending subjects when we teach. So I've noticed that the classical education world does this very well. Homeschool does this very well, where you might teach writing, but you're using paragraphs about history to teach the writing. So you kill two birds with one stone, you know, and I don't think our schools do enough of that. And on the Submarine and the Spy book that just came out, it's a novel for ages 12 and up. So for eighth graders, but you can teach it in literature class as the hero's journey, or you can teach it in an American history class. So you can, it's a way of combining. And I don't think we do enough of that. And I noticed that in the books, the, you know, textbooks of the 1800s, people were learning to read based on stories about George Washington, about Lafayette, stories from the Bible. So from the beginning, we actually did a good job of combining subjects, but we really drifted away from that. And we've been kind of a narcissistic, me, me, me culture. A lot of the reading is very focused on individual, you know, superfluous things. So I think we've got an opportunity to write the course.
Do you think there's a deliberate agenda here, Jane? Do you think there are people who don't want our young people to know our history? I mean, we're coming up on the 250th anniversary of our country, and You know, our founding fathers are being demonized now regularly, not just in our schools, but our universities, the media. They're being portrayed as these evildoers. Do you think there is an agenda to conceal the real history from our young people?
Yes, I definitely think there is an agenda, that it's coming from the ideological spectrum on the left. It's really a communist tactic. That's what the communists did, and the Soviets did in Russia, was they destroyed their history and didn't want people to talk about the past. And that, so it is a very dangerous thing. You really do need to know the truth. And you need to know, you can't study absolutely everything, but you need to also have a healthy perspective when we look at history. You need to teach the difficult things, but you need to also have an optimistic viewpoint when you teach. And I think we've got this really, it's called harsh history. It's a very negative viewpoint, and it doesn't give people hope. And I think that's something, you know, that we need to work on. And I've been working on my Substack series, janehamptoncook.substack.com. I have several articles about how the Declaration of Independence influenced our greatest civil rights movements, because I realized that clause about creation in the Declaration of Independence, that we are endowed by a creator with inalienable rights, that really motivated people. It motivated Susan B. Anthony, Martin Luther King, Harriet Beecher Stowe. So how we got out of slavery was because people embraced the belief that all men and women are created equal. They have equal value to God. They're not all the same, but they have equal value and worth. And that is really what brought us through our history, is that idea.
Yeah. And that set the stage for ending slavery, not just in the United States, but really around the world. You know, one of the things that I realize our young people have no clue is that slavery has been ubiquitous throughout human history. In Mauritania, slavery wasn't even criminalized until 2007. The Saudis didn't do it until about 50 years ago. And yet young people in America think America is just uniquely evil because there was slavery here at one time. Terrible distortion of the history. One of your new books, you actually talk about, like, you know, the fake news thing, the dishonesty, the lies, the agenda. You know, a lot of us think that that's kind of a contemporary development, but you show in your book that even back in 1776, there was fake news trying to demonize, for example, George Washington. Talk a little bit about this tactic and how evildoers like to spread lies and misinformation.
Yeah, so my book, War of Lies, when George Washington was the target and propaganda was the crime, looks at 18th century fake news. And George Washington was attacked in newspapers. He was called an assassin during the French and Indian War. That was a lie. He got someone that knew what really happened to, you know, refute the lie and reveal the truth. But when he was commander of the Continental Army, there was a counterfeit letter propaganda campaign that was published in newspapers. So it was letters from Washington as if he was writing his wife and other family members, but they were all fake and people thought they were real. And so my book looks into four suspects of who could have written them. And really what it is, it's this internal battle of jealousy. People get jealous and sometimes, and that can drive someone to counterfeit someone's letters. And so that's really, I think, what drives a lot of the fake news. It's a purposeful manipulation to steer people one direction or another. And oftentimes that direction is away from the truth.
Yeah. So what happened back in 1776? You mentioned his name was eventually cleared, but was fake news just as common and just as dangerous back then as it is today, or worse?
I don't think it was just as common as it is today. I don't think it was as purposefully wrong. So what was fake a lot of times back then was just that they were so far away from each other that you might have a false report, but you wouldn't know that it was false for several months because it took weeks, you know, for letters to travel. So it was a lot of just mistakes in a lot of ways. But during wartime, there definitely was an effort to skew the public. You know, there was a British newspaper publisher, James Rivington. His job was to, you know, was narrative building in favor of the king. And so, you know, during wartime, we definitely see the intentional fake news, the intentional propaganda is very common.
You know, we got the 250th anniversary of our country's birthday coming up in 2026. And, you know, it's a real question mark. What is that going to look like? Are we even going to have a country by 2026? Is it going to look anything like it does today, like it was supposed to look, like it looked 50 years ago? That I think is yet to be determined. But you're doing a lot on this front, Jane. I want to talk about your children's book. You just last weekend, you were reading this at one of the Kirk Cameron Library events. And so you wrote this book. It's called First Fireworks for Independence. Talk about the book. What's in it and why did you decide to write it?
Well, I discovered that the first people to launch fireworks for independence were Virginians, and that they met in a convention in May of 1776. They said, we're done with the king. They wanted Congress, the Continental Congress, to declare independence. And then they decided to celebrate because they were at their wit's end. There was just no more law and order. The king had dissolved the Virginia legislature. And so they said, we're done. And they celebrated with a parade and fireworks the next day. And I looked, because now historical newspapers have been digitized, so you can keyword search. And I could not find any earlier instance of anyone launching fireworks for the purpose of celebrating independence. And so I thought, this is something we need to know, because we celebrate independence every year through fireworks. I think it's a great way to connect the present with the past. And so I wrote this book from the point of view of Virginia Randolph, who was the granddaughter of one of the founders. And so the opening of the book asks you to, you know, if you can guess who her grandfather was. And then at the end, I reveal which founding father Virginia's grandfather was. But you get to see when fireworks were first launched for July 4th in Philadelphia, Boston, New York, Charleston, and of course, Williamsburg. And so it's just a fun, fun look at that topic.
That's awesome. How did the event at the library go? Yeah, I love Kirk Cameron. In fact, I was just in his most recent documentary about homeschooling, a great film. And of course, he's a great American. But I know he's been getting a lot of pushback. A lot of the libraries don't want him to come. You know, a lot of the LGBT crowd, they're showing up to protest. How dare you talk about God to these children? You know, let us dance naked in front of them. Truly incredible. But how did the event go? I know John Solomon was there. You mentioned, was it well attended? Was there pushback?
No, we didn't have any protesters. It was well attended. We filled this room. There were 70 people, I think, in the room. It was a room that was designed in the library so you could get to it from the outside of the library. So it was actually before the library even opened. And it was really nice. And John talked about free speech, because that's what his children's book is about, is freedom of speech. And, you know, it's a good thing. And there were very, I think the enthusiasm was what the people wanted to be there. These were parents who wanted their children to hear some patriotic books and to get back to, you know, just good old fashioned traditional values. And that's what that event was all about. And it was a success nationwide, because they had like 300-350 events across the country on Saturday. So it was really good.
Oh, that's fantastic. I'm glad to hear it. Now, the other book that you have just put out recently, The Submarine and the Spies, Friendship and Vigilance in the American Revolution. Tell us a little bit about this book and what are the lessons for today?
Well, so this book takes place, it starts off at Yale, and there are three classmates at Yale who are in the same social club, and they go on to do some amazing things during the American Revolution. But what binds them together is friendship. And I think that's a good topic for, you know, ages 12 and up, to think about friendship. And you realize that they all had to make a sacrifice to be a part of the American Revolution. And their names were Benjamin Talmadge, Nathan Hale, and David Bushnell. And David Bushnell invented the first submarine. Nathan Hale became a spy, and he gave his life for our country. And he was vigilant as a spy. He was watching over. He was doing what George Washington wanted him to do, which was to gather information about the British movements on Long Island. And then Benjamin Talmadge was best friends with Nathan. And he could not speak about Nathan's death. He was so distraught, he couldn't even speak of it. But when George Washington asked Benjamin Talmadge to be his spy master, he almost, it seems like he did that in the name of Nathan Hale. And he was very discreet, would not give away any information, even when Continental Army generals would ask him. And so it was really, it's all about that hero's journey. They were fighting for their home of Connecticut, their homes in Long Island. And that was really what the revolution was to them, is that they wanted their homes to be free. And so it's a nice, you know, book about friendship. And then vigilance is the theme. And that's what the meaning of the color blue in our flag. One of the meanings, one of those virtues, is vigilance, which means watching over. And that's what you've been doing. You've been watching over what's going on in the country and reporting on it. And we need vigilance to be aware of dangers and trends that undermine, you know, what it means to be an American.
That's awesome. Really appreciate it, Jane. So what's the best way for people to find these books and follow your work?
Well, they're on Amazon.com, all of the books. I do have a shop on my website, janecook.com/shop. And I did put a promo code out there for Alex is the promo code. So if you want to get them through my shop, they're autographed through my shop. And, you know, and I do have a Substack, janehamptoncook.substack.com. And I post a lot of articles and write my writings there. So that's okay. How to get a hold of me.
Fantastic. Well, hey, really appreciate it, Jane. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for talking about these books. I am not going to be getting any of the revenue from the books, as far as I know, despite the promo code. But yeah, folks, go out there, check out the books. Important work. And we really do need our young people to understand American history. It's just so significant. So thanks again, Jane Hampton Cook. Really appreciate you coming on. Folks, thank you for watching. Again, check out the books. I'm Alex Newman. This is Conversations That Matter for the New American Magazine. Until next time, God bless you all.
Sophia paused before the door. It read, Department of Bi-Digital Convergence. Just inside was a new world, a better world, the one of everlasting life, of no pain, of no loss, of no problem. She entered the chamber and her surroundings changed. She saw around her an infinite field of waving golden grain surmounted by cloudless blue sky. The AI voice whispered gently in her mind, Welcome to the singularity. She couldn't see it and couldn't feel it, but her body had almost instantly been covered by a swarm of tiny gray multi-legged bots that melted through her clothes and into her skin. Not perceiving the nightmare, her eyes had already been consumed and the rest of her body was dissolving as the bots digested her flesh. She felt only a warmth suffusing her being. Drowsy, she drifted to sleep, and her last thought was one of panic. Would she ever wake? Could a nightmare vision like this be an outcome of the much-hyped transhumanist technological singularity? Enter the world of the future as illuminated by the experience of the past in Endgame, the new book by Dennis Barrett, the publisher of The New American Magazine, and find out how the disastrous COVID pandemic response fits with the technocratic elite's thirst to create a transhumanist utopia. Get Endgame from shopjbs.org with free shipping with code ENDSHIP, ENDSHIP. Or get Endgame and the Great Reset Collector's issue of The New American Magazine and get free shipping plus an additional 20% off both with code END20, END20.
Welcome back. Joining me for the action segment of the program is CEO of the John Birch Society, Bill Hahn. Welcome back, Bill. We just had you on yesterday.
Absolutely. Happy to be here again.
Yes, and I'm glad to have you. Today, you're going to be talking about nullifying gun bans. So have a way at it. I'm sure there's lots of people who are interested in knowing how in the heck do we do that.
Well, I tell you, I was very impressed by the state of Illinois.
And of all places,
absolutely, you know, and they most specifically, so back, I think it was July 4th of 2022, there was a shooting that had happened at one of their, I think it was Hyde Park, and seven people dead, many, many, many wounded. And the cowardly act that was done actually prompted the state legislature to put together, you know, a gun control measure, which, of course, that the Governor Pritzker had just dutifully signed.
Yeah.
And it went through. So it was supposed to start, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, beginning of this year. And what it's supposed to do, it bans, you know, the black guns, right? The racist black guns.
The scary ones?
Yes, the scary ones, right? And so
the ARs,
the AR-15s, yep, the semi-automatic, obviously, and any large capacity magazines, you know, rifles and whatnot, cannot hold any more than 10. Like that's a magical number of, you know, of some sorts, right?
Yeah.
That plus the existing or the owners of these existing weapons. There's no confiscation, but they must be registered with the Illinois State Police.
Yeah.
Well, I'm happy to report that by January 2023, there was at least 75 county sheriffs.
No kidding.
That stood up and said, we're not doing this. We're not enforcing this. Yes.
Do you know how many counties
there are? There are 102 counties in the state of Illinois, so do the math. Okay. Now, as of like last few weeks, that number has grown to more than 90. So
that's almost 90% of the counties, right?
Absolutely it is.
Wow.
Yeah. So that being said, the act of not doing something is a form of interpositioning or nullification. And this is something that the Founding Fathers had talked about. And it's actually something that the John Birch Society has been teaching for decades.
Yeah.
You know, we have a booklet on Article 6, and it details, you know, the right of the individual that of the elected individual to nullify unconstitutional measures that hurt their constituents.
Do we know what kind of pressure or information was given to these sheriffs? I take it there was probably, I mean, we've seen this, and I know I've worked during COVID with friends who are like, hey, we have to talk to the sheriff. He has to know that his job is to protect us, not enforce these edicts. Do we have any information on what they were doing down there in Illinois?
Well, we know for sure. Obviously, the Birch Society has been, you know, been strong throughout the years, you know, on this particular issue, particularly with its, you know, support your local police, you know, campaign that it's had. But we've also had, you know, other partners that have helped us out greatly in this area. And one of them is Sheriff Richard Mack.
Ah.
Okay. He back in, I can't remember the date, sometime in 2010 or so, maybe even before that, had started an association called the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association, CSPOA. And the John Birch Society was one of the first members that have gotten on board with, you know, with that. And he's a fantastic example of nullification. So he was a former sheriff when he was a sheriff during the Clinton administration. Yeah. He had gotten into
successfully sued the administration.
Successfully
right?
sued, yeah, because of the Brady bill, and he wasn't going to enforce this in his area either.
Yeah.
So he, you know, pushed that through. Through a lawsuit and went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and he won it. So where and so the media is turning itself inside out with articles that are saying, you know, with other experts that are saying sheriffs can't ignore the, you know, the rule of law, and so on and so forth. That's not in their purview. But yet, as some folks have pointed out, some of these sheriffs have pointed out, they answer only to their constituents, the folks that put them into office. And that's what makes this so very powerful.
It's a great example because this can be used otherwise, as we hinted earlier. Again, yesterday we reported on what seems to be mask mandates coming
That's
back
right.
and things like
That's
that.
Right.
That would apply to this as well, would it not?
Yes. Let me ask your audience a question, and I'll wait for the answer. Yeah. What was the only tool that gave immediate relief during the COVID lockdowns? Yes, sir.
Was it nullification?
It was nullification. Absolutely. Yes. So not only did they have to not wait, you know, for their city councils to act or their state's attorneys to act or their state legislature to act or their state Supreme Court or the U.S. Supreme Court to act. It was done because of sheriffs that had said, hey, we're not doing this. This is un-American.
What do we say to people who are watching or listening? It's like you had mentioned the booklet, Article 6. I think you're talking about Article 6, not Article 5, right?
Is Absolutely.
Say they want say the say there's people listening. They're like, man, how can I help my sheriff understand about nullification? What do we recommend? The Article 6, not Article 5. We could go JBS.org and there's a book. There's a shop there, right? We have tons
Absolutely,
of pamphlets,
yeah.
right?
As a matter of fact, if you go to the I think it's the
our COVID Action Project, we have on that Action Project page a little icon of that booklet, and you can click on it and download it for free.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah. So you could even send them a link. You know,
absolutely.
Maybe you can't get in the office and have a conversation, but if you have your email, you can send it and say, "Hey, Sheriff such and such, I wanted to share this with you," and you know. They can obviously personalize it and whatnot.
Yep, yep, absolutely.
Any other tools? Any other things that people can do?
Yeah, well, we also have put this. We had this conversation before in regards to nullification. So there are plenty of videos out there that the New American puts out. Also in the most latest issue of the magazine.
Yeah, flash that bad boy.
Right,
there
right. Hot out of the box, right out of the warehouse today. I was told that this is not even in the system yet, so I just grabbed it as it came in.
And the perks of being the boss.
Absolutely. So on my article in here, it says nullification. Does it again.
Gets it done again.
Yeah. This is the taking action column. These things are done, every single issue.
It happens.
These things can be shared.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good and nullification tools. Happens on a pretty normal basis. Going back, as we finish up here, during COVID, we saw county sheriffs from sea to shining sea, right, in California and even in New York, they nullified various COVID-related edicts.
That's right, yeah. And another in the last few seconds we've got, another organization that is stuck by us, with this particular topic, is the 10th Amendment Center out of California. Those guys do great work as well.
Absolutely.
They really help us out with getting, they do an annual nullification report, and love the tool.
Absolutely.
Use it.
Yeah, we can't emphasize this enough. Thank you, Bill Hahn. Thank you so much. And that's it for our show today, folks. We are done. We thank you for tuning in for another episode of The New American TV. Remember to go to thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news and visit jbs.org, where we have plenty of tools that you can use to help your sheriff understand about nullification. Well, have a good one, and we'll see you tomorrow.